Tonight, we are honored to have Courtney J. Martin, the Deputy Director and Chief Curator at the DIA Art Foundation, here to present her erudite perspective on the work of the artist Robert Ryman. Prior to the DIA, Courtney taught in the History of Art and Architecture Department at Brown University, as well as Vanderbilt. She was Chancellor's postdoctoral fellow at UC Berkeley, a fellow at the Getty Research Institute, and a Henry Moore Institute research fellow. She has been recognized with an Andy Warhol Foundation Arts Writers Grant and has worked in the Media, Arts, and Culture Unit of the Ford Foundation in New York. So here they all come. With a doctorate from Yale, for her research on 20th century British art, she has written on numerous artists, including from this museum's collection, to name just two of many, Ed Ruscha and Yinka Shonabar. In 2012, Courtney curated a focused display at Tate Modern, Drop, Roll, Slide, Drip, Frank Bowling's Poured Paintings, 1973 to 78. From 2008 to 2015, she co-led a research project on the Anglo-American art critic Lawrence Alloway at the Getty, and she is co-editor of Lawrence Alloway, Critic and Curator, Getty Publication 2015, which won the 2016 Historians of British Art Book Award. In 2015, Courtney curated Robert Ryman at the DIA Art Foundation, which is, of course, the impetus of tonight's lecture, and which could not make me happier. As noted from even this abbreviated introduction, Courtney could have spoken on a wide array of topics, but I was thrilled when she opted for the subject of the DIA exhibition. I am especially enthusiastic about her remarks in a Wall Street Journal review of the show. Quote, "White is what everyone thinks of when they think of Ryman. I'm hoping we'll disturb that. With a fresh eye, she instead investigates Ryman's longtime compositional concerns with space, depth, and distance as questions of painting rather than sculpture." So with that in mind, please join me in welcoming Courtney J. Martin.
Hi. It's nice to see so many friends in the audience. May I ask for the lights to be lowered, please? I'm really just putting this slide here because it's just a really good one. It's showing Bob in his studio in the 90s, and it's looking over onto him from the top. His studio is actually a former space where theater productions were staged, so it is incredibly a huge height of ceilings, quite narrow, actually. And so he can do a lot of his large-scale works right there and kind of restage exhibitions. It's a wonderful place. It is a great pleasure to be here at the Modern Art Museum of Fort Worth. I would like to thank Curator of Education Terry Thornton for inviting me to speak in the Tuesday evening series. I'd also like to thank Amy Cardoso for making all of the arrangements for the trip. In early 2015, I was asked to curate an exhibition of Robert Ryman's paintings for the DIA Art Foundation. At the time, I was not a part of the institution, as I am now, but I had long thought about its collection as a part of my own scholarship of the 60s and 70s. When I began thinking about how the Ryman exhibition for DIA Chelsea might take place, I returned to my notes on and memories of other exhibitions of his paintings to think through what I knew about his practice and what I might add to this vast exhibition history. One of my first realizations was that this important American painter had only rarely been shown singly in American museums, and that this show would be the first institutional presentation of his painting since the 1993 Museum of Modern Art retrospective. Curated by Robert Storr, this show was the most comprehensive exhibition of the artist's work ever held in the United States. It comprised almost 80 works, dating from 1955 to those straight from the artist's studio. Due to Ryman's renown in Europe, many of these works had not been seen in many years or ever in the United States. After closing in New York in 1994, the show would travel for a few years to the then Tate Gallery in London, the Reina Sofia in Madrid, the San Francisco Museum of Art, and to the Walker Art Center in Minneapolis. Central to this exhibition was the recovery of paintings that reframed the ways in which Ryman was viewed by the public. For many, Ryman painted small, all-white squares. That's it. Storr brought out color, technique, and scale to dissuade this limited view of Ryman. Perhaps the most notable inclusion was the orange painting. Likely one of his earliest completed paintings, dating from his first years in New York when he transitioned from playing saxophone to being a painter. While researching this show, I learned from one of Ryman's close friends and a frequent curator of and writer about his work, Naomi Spector, that she once went to Nashville, Tennessee to retrieve this painting from Ryman's family. As a Nashville native myself, I was enchanted by the idea that this painting once hung in a home very near my own childhood home before being returned to New York. I think that it seemed to me that the exceptional character of this painting replaced the place of Bob in his family's life, but then when it needed to come back to New York to be shown, they were ready to let it go. I like this as a metaphor. The 1993 retrospective also included a small painting that deeply impacted the artist's ability to make that first leap into art making. Titled To Gertrude Mellon, the painting was purchased by Mrs. Mellon from the staff exhibition at MoMA in 1958. There, Ryman worked as a guard during the day and painted at night. He hung out with Dan Flavin, he'd met Donald Judd, he knew many of the people who were in the circle. The staff show was his first group exhibition, and the sale of the work his first as well. In viewing this painting, I imagine that its diminutive size belies its deep import as a crucial incentive to keep painting and to keep showing his early work. This is not an insignificant objective for an untrained painter as Bob was. He trained as a musician, not as a painter. I knew that my show needed to highlight color and the ways in which color was present in his earliest through to his latest works, even if much of the field only discussed the achromatic surfaces of these same works. It is for these reasons I thought it important to include this painting in the Dia show. I wanted viewers to know of Ryman's early surfaces, and moreover, I wanted artists of all stages to have a subtle reminder of how often success can be measured in small steps. It is for these reasons that I hung it next to the large painting from the 1980s so that all might see scale as something that can be fine-tuned for effect. From the 1993 show, I turned to a show that I had never seen, the 1972 Solomon R. Guggenheim Museum exhibition. Curated by Diane Waldman, this show was the artist's first solo exhibition in a New York museum. It presented 38 of his works dated from 1965 to 1972. Crucial to this show was the inclusion of large-scale works that showed not only Ryman's ability to inhabit space, but also his ability to use materials not known for their volume or for their mass. Classico 4 is one of a series of compositions consisting of multi-panel paintings made from the purposeful brand of Classico paper. For each work in the series, Ryman attached a configuration of heavy, creamy white sheets of the paper to a wall with masking tape, painted the sheets with a shiny white acrylic paint, then removed the tape when the sheets were dry, mounted each of those sheets onto foam core, and then reattached each one to the wall in a grid. The Classico series differs in the organization of paper sheets, the number of panels, the configuration of tape traces, and the painted shape, yet they share an emphasis on the thinness of the support surface and its alignment with the wall and the monumentality conceived of as an accumulation of parts. And I just want to point out here, I'm not sure if it's harder to see, perhaps those in the back can see it really easily, but this is where you see the paint outline, but each of these is actually painted individually, and then they are refitted together to make this whole grid. So you get spatters of paint down here, and then you get closer up, and you feel you're almost to the edge, whereas there's a lot of space here between the end of the painting and the edge of what would be the canvas. For the Dia Chelsea presentation, I located Classico 6, a work from 1968 that demonstrated Ryman's interest in working larger, demarcating space, and manipulating the soft property of paper into a seemingly hard support. It is a compelling work made more so by its installation. It is now attached to the wall panel by magnets, so each one is actually stuck on with magnets. I noticed upstairs that there is a Teresita Fernandez work that includes the use of magnets as a form of the installation as well, and I thought that was a compelling comparison between the two because the magnets, of course, are not visible, and yet it is exactly that invisibility that makes them so important to the piece. A part of the artist-owned collection, Classico 6 is currently on view in Beacon in place of another that was sent out for conservation. I've spent the last month or so being reminded of how complicated it is to use thin sheets of paper as a base for painting practice. In the back of my mind, of course, Ryman's long relationship with Dia. His first solo show, of course, was held at Dia in 1988. This really held sway over what I was thinking about what to do with this show. Curated by Gary Garrels, the show inaugurated the Dia Collection's transition from being a public-private entity that only presented parts of its collection to being a fully-fledged museum that would arrange exhibitions of works by artists not in the collection, which is true of Ryman at the time. He was not in our collection. That show led to Dia's first exhibition catalog and to some of the same principles that Dia holds to the present, such as working directly with living artists as fully as possible. On the then remote 22nd Street between 10th and 11th Avenues, this was one of the first real museum exhibitions of art to be held in what is now the Chelsea District of New York. That was supposed to be a nod towards the exoticism of the idea of New York having this kind of lonesome space, which is completely gone. To that end, when Dia moved from 22nd Street to the Hudson River Valley in 2003, Ryman worked closely with the staff to select, arrange, and install his long-term installation at Dia Beacon. These rooms represent Ryman's exacting vision for his works in this place at that moment. It is, to my mind, one of the best examples of why working with artists can be so fulfilling. In preparation for the show, I was excited to see so many more of his paintings as much as I was challenged to think about organizing them in a manner that explained the aesthetic richness presented by this painter and by his exhibition history. I thought of these moments of research as well as my own memories of having seen the work as encounters. As such, I spoke to as many people as I could who had seen the 1988 show because this connection was important to me and I hope to Ryman. The second gallery of the 2015 show exactly replicates how I ingested this work over the course of that year. There were the works that demonstrated Ryman's understanding of the relationship between the painting and the wall by way of fasteners, hardware, and what I thought of as sure-handed determination. In other works, Ryman's sincere and long-term experimentation with the interaction of light and color on the canvas is front and center. These works are adjacent to others that demonstrate a material curiosity and a willingness to experiment in the field of metals. Here, for example, is the wall that makes plain the profoundly frustrating and fulfilling conversations that many painters have with the edges of their compositions. The paintings that I selected for the north or back wall of the larger gallery combine some aspect of all of the best attributes of the rest of the objects in the show, I think. From the onset of organizing the show, I was struck by their formal complexity, cool surfaces, and multiple engagements with space. All completed within a few years of each other in the 1980s and with a limited range of tools and materials, yet they do not form a series or a named group like many others in his practice do. Dia's long commitment to minimalism also means that any artist within the sphere of Dia is also appointed a minimalist, whether they like it or not. Ryman, however, didn't agree with this and didn't follow this line. Does not, I should say. He still does not agree with this and does not follow this line. Though he was familiar with those artists and with their work, he was a painter who saw himself as such, but despite the terms by which he delivered shaped canvases. Taken together, or examined one by one, these works have led me to pose larger questions about the state of the three-dimensional object in Ryman's painting practice. And just to be clear here, even if we end up seeing objects that we would all, I think, arguably call sculptural to some degree, Ryman really insists that these are paintings and should be described as such. Despite the seeming two-dimensionality of most of his paintings, as early as the mid-1960s, curators, critics, and viewers were aware of the possibility of the object within his output. Perhaps the most obvious example of this is the inclusion of allied in systemic painting. Curator Lawrence Alloway's final exhibition at the Guggenheim Museum. On view throughout the fall of 1966, the show featured 28 New York-based painters in an installation that encompassed almost the entirety of the museum. Ryman joined a list that included Joe Baer, Ellsworth Kelly, Kenneth Noland, Frank Stella, and others. Though each artist took a different approach, most worked in a large scale, utilized high-keyed colored, and many employed various innovative methods such as shaped canvases or enameling directly onto a canvas. Conceptually, systemic embodied a loose layman's interpretation of systems theory, an interdisciplinary study of order developed in the hard sciences. Notable to critics and viewers, however, were the large number of paintings that were rendered in relief, this sense that paintings were moving out from the wall into open space. Though the show lacked a conclusive explanation of the relationship between systems theory and painting practices, the prevalence of objects that lived between the painting and the sculpture binary was a feature that defined the show and best illustrated something about the systemic. Within this curatorial concept and installed in the museum's demonstrative architecture, Allied could be seen for its potential toward dimensionality. In fact, Alloway described this potential as matter painting, a form that he placed halfway between painting and sculpture, not unlike Donald Judd's understanding of the specific object, save for the point of departure. Alloway started from the point of view of painting and Judd from sculpture. As objects, matter painting was decidedly abstract and devoted to occupying literal space rather than creating the illusion of space. While this may not have been a true reflection of Allied's actual physical characteristics, its presence in the exhibition makes the most sense as a sort of meditation on what the space around a painting might add to the composition just at the moment at which Ryman claimed literal space as a constituent of his compositions. So this is Lawrence Alloway there curating the show, and this is Diane Waldman standing just to the rear of him. She will curate the 1972 show, but at the time she's working as his assistant curator on this show. It almost seems as if that relationship is clear by the way that they're standing, that she's sort of looking over, kind of watching, learning at the time. I was inspired by this image when I spoke with Diane. I asked her when she first started thinking about her 1972 Ryman show that would become the artist's first solo show in New York, first solo museum show, rather, in New York. She told me that Ryman's work had stood out to her early in her career and that working on systemic painting was not the first time that she'd encountered him, but that she was very interested in his placement in the show and had been wandering around Soho and West Broadway really looking for these paintings. In the early 1970s, Ryman began experimenting with wooden supports. The experimentations are concurrent with others in metals and plastic that he undertook in the same decade. Perhaps it is the aftermath of the space race and the prevalence of new materials that the aeronautics and space industries released into the open market that supported Ryman's natural curiosity about ground. Or, as other writings suggest, the wooden support was simply a problem to be solved. Whatever the occasion or the prompt, Ryman began using pre-made wooden doors as supports. These structures are hollow, thinly constructed, and relatively lightweight. Varese Wall is one such structure. Installed in the first year that Dia Beacon opened in 2003, Varese dates from 1975. By definition, a wall is a continuous vertical structure that defines an area. The scale of a wall often notates its purpose as one of enclosure, shelter, architecture, or decoration, though any of these attributes may be combined for multiple purposes. Despite the suggestion of this title, Varese Wall is not a single structure, nor is it load-bearing, save for the layers of paint that have been applied to it over the years. The painting is actually made of six wooden door panels held together by six corresponding metal rods, the entirety of which is painted over and sits over five blue foam blocks of the type often used to protect objects from another surface, like that of a painting in process resting on an artist's studio floor. Each time the Varese is installed, it must be fully repainted. Measuring 8.5 feet high and 24 feet long, it is objectively large, and for Ryman's practice, one of the largest works that he has completed to date. As you can see in this image, Varese does not rest on the wall. It is braced to stand just over 1.5 feet away from the wall. And its relationship to the wall creates a kind of negative space of just enough width that it can neither be transgressed by a human body nor completely ignored. None of the children who come to Beacon seem to want to ignore it. They like to walk behind it, which they should not be doing. This space, this sort of transgressive space, is as close as I think that Ryman comes to an aggressive gesture or a directive in his practice. In 1975, the year that Varese was completed, was an important one for Ryman. He had a well-received solo show at the Kunsthalle in Basel, and he began experimenting with the fasteners and fittings that would officially make their appearance in paintings in the following year. Here, I show you an example of an early work in which fasteners are to be taken as a part of the whole rather than an added object. And I show you here the fasteners that are actually as much of the work as the paint itself. The presence of the fasteners indicates that we need to look at the wall around the work to see the sides, front, top, and bottom without the limitation of the edge of the canvas. Perhaps we might even look to Varese as a kind of prototype for these works because of its physical projection away from the wall and the visible supports on both its backside and bottom edge. The work's evocative title has a seemingly straightforward provenance. Varese was commissioned by Italian art patron Giuseppe Panza di Buomo for inclusion in his museum-scaled estate in Varese, Italy, thus the Varese Wall. In the interview with curator Gary Garrels that accompanied his 1988 exhibition at Dia, he describes the sculptural feel of Varese as an incident of his process rather than his intent. He intended, as he explained, to make a room in Panza's villa that could allow for the changeable conditions of the northwestern Lombardy region that resulted in the villa's damp walls. He continues with the following, quote, "I was trying to devise a way to line the walls with metal foil because I wanted to paint on wooden veneer panels. I was working on a way to join them together so that they would line the room on three sides. Behind them would be the metal foil to keep the moisture off of the wood, end quote. His practical solution to the very real problem presented by the space and its atmosphere was met by a desire to see the piece away from the wall, to see it sit on the floor, to be able to see its surface front and back. He wanted it to be, quote, totally naked, a phrase that I think invites the transparency of the painting's relationship to the space that it inhabits. Here, we might substitute the word naked for literal, or more appropriately, anti-illusionistic. In this and other interviews, Ryman has recounted viewing Pan's estate and its surrounding area where he perhaps encountered the high walls that lined both sides of the hilly road leading away from the city of Arese up to the Villa Panza. We should all have more time just to look at this. Just in case. Varese, of course, is the site of the Sacro Monte di Varese, the Sacred Mount of Varese, the well-worn mountaintop pilgrimage site that charts the mystery of Christ's life. The holy road that leads to this site is also lined on both sides by a low stone wall. I point out this occurrence not to suggest a one-to-one match of the Varese wall's extended surface based on either account or location. Rather, I use these examples to point to what I think is at stake in constituting a painting as an immovable object. How might we encounter this work not as sculpture or architecture, but as material permanence? How might we construe the significant material renewal required to destabilize that permanence? Though I situated this idea within the context of the three-dimensional, I am now challenged to pay attention to the properties of fixity, duration, and stability as functions of painting. It is helpful here, perhaps, for me to think about Lucio Fontana's concept of spatialism. First promoted in his Manifesto Blanco of 1946, spatialism was his attempt as a painter to transcend the confines of the two-dimensional plane. In his first manifesto, Fontana announced his goals for a spatialist art, one that could engage technology to achieve an expression of the fourth dimension in a radical new aesthetic idiom that melded the categories of architecture, sculpture, and painting. Fontana's concept might be a constructive way to consider how Varese functions as an architectonic painting, all the while maintaining its medium specificity as a painting in Ryman's understanding. The scale, the active reapplication of paint required to install, and the place name title suggest that Ryman's commission for Panza might have been intended as a site-specific work and or long-term display for the villa, like the others that remain on site, such as those by his contemporaries and some friends, Robert Irwin, James Terrell, or Dan Fladman. His permanent installation in the Villa Panza is seen here. All of their works, like his, were acquired and installed between 1973 and 1976. It is clear that it was to be a piece with this project. Varese, however, was never installed at the Villa Panza. It was constructed in Ryman's studio, where it was propped up by blue foam as he worked on it. The studio adjustment gave him an idea, however, to display it this way. Though commissioned for Panza, it was first shown at the John Weber Gallery in November of 1975. There, Ryman retained the foam blocks partly because they had, through the course of its production, become inseparable for him from any other aspect of the composition. In his words, he described it as being so used to these foam blocks that they are part of the painting. I just couldn't see it any other way, end quote. Within their compositional function, there was also practicality. In the same passage, he notes that the floor of the Weber Gallery space at 420 West Broadway in Manhattan's Soho was uneven. So the foam blocks doubled back to their original function as a way to stabilize the large painting. I show this earlier image of Weber's gallery so that you have a sense of the floor. Unfortunately, the image that actually shows the Varese wall makes it look as if the floor is perfectly fine. What Ryman didn't say about Weber's gallery was that it was one of few in Soho in which his large work, large pristine work, I should say, could have been shown. Other galleries in the area were either smaller or less finished. They lacked the physical depth in their space to be able to show the work adequately. The space between the real wall and the wall of the work would not be realized, and the object and the distance that viewers would need to view it was also not available. In addition to serving as a kind of beta model for the later works with fasteners, the Varese wall is also an antecedent for the group of three-dimensional paintings that Ryman completed in the 1980s. Without name or designation as a series, these paintings have a specific place within the practice. In the early 1980s, Ryman began working with a fabricator, a stretcher maker, named Josh Begeyer in Brooklyn. He had previously made other stretchers and supports for him and had been to Ryman, I think, a kind of fix-it-all person who came up with great solutions to Ryman's many problems with the ways that he wanted to approach his canvases. With Begeyer, he developed an aluminum or fiberglass honeycomb lattice structure that would form the interiors of the support. Paint could then be applied onto them. This structure was both a replacement for and improvement on the thin, hollow panels used for the Varese wall. Here, I show you an example of the type of honeycombed interior, next to an example of the type of hollowed panel used in Varese wall. So you see that open space here, and then you see how the space has actually become full with another material, but is actually much more lightweight and far more durable. Lightweight, more resilient, definitely more durable, these new supports could be formed in ways that matched Ryman's thinking about surface and ground. But they did not need to be repainted each time they were shown, as is the case with Varese. Nor did these new works need require metal rods for stability. To my knowledge, there are only 7 of these paintings, and of those 7, only 3 are at a substantial relief to be described as fully three-dimensional. These are Pace, Factor, and Pair Navigation. The three-dimensional paintings were first shown from February to March of 1984 at the New York outpost of what was then Galerie Mate Lalong, which later became the Lalong Gallery. This space was a temporary office on 57th Street that was used before the new gallery in New York would open. Both were established as a way to serve or mind the French gallery's American artists, such as Edward Kienholz, Jim Dine, and Ryman. This exhibition of 3 works was a kind of preview for the larger show in Paris that opened later in the spring of 1984 and featured all 7 in the group. In the New York display, Factor and Pace dominated the small area, giving way to a sense that these works were overtly monumental, a physical departure from the Ryman known for his small, painterly white squares. The fabricated works are a result of his investigations in the decade prior into radical modes of painting and presentation. Take Pace. The painting is a small square placed horizontally. From this position, its face, as it were, is positioned for the viewer to look onto it from above. So there, you sort of stare down on top of it, or from the top of it. From a slight distance, the narrow band of redwood indicates the edge of the canvas, suggesting that this is a painting on a solid wooden panel, which, of course, it is not. Instead, it is a fiberglass construction painted over a reflective white enamel. The small wall fasteners hold the work in place, while the long, thin aluminum legs make a show of the verticality of the painting. They are, in fact, not necessary to keep it standing. It would be easy to describe this work as sculptural, and perhaps even easier to categorize it as minimalist. It is fabricated, composed of raw materials, new materials, and streamlined in a manner that supports a generalized understanding of that period of artists and the objects that they made. But pace and factor and pair navigation beside it were conceived, composed, and displayed in the 1980s, well after the origins of minimalism would have allowed it to exist without acknowledging its discourse. Let me be clear. I do not think that Ryman is trying to make minimal objects, nor do I think that he is trying to periodize his output. Rather, I think he knew full well what criticisms would be lobbed at him and how the work would be received. In this case, largely it has been overlooked to the sort of depth of the rest of his painting practice. And yet, why would someone so sure of their materials and their functions make objects that obscured their own construction? Why would he knowingly place these objects at heights that allude to a familiar strain of domesticity, if not also a period of design? I looked at all of these examples as a series of encounters that one might have toward the practice rather than away from it. While I do not have the big answers to these questions, I am certain that what is happening with these paintings is strategic. There is a way in which one cannot look at these works and not take seriously the innovation of contemporary painting, both then in the 80s and now. These works force us to look above and below, while looking from above, below, and around. They demand a viewership that is engaged somewhere between forcing viewers to become spectators or participants. In each, the canvas, as it were, has become a plane that is a total field. I'm borrowing this concept of field from Pierre Bourdieu's use of the term field, wherein a field, like art, is constituted by the set of ever-shifting conditions that determine its corpus at any one time. In Ryman's three-dimensional paintings, or our field. Well, you know what it looks like. Our field starts with the painted plane and extends out to the rest of his practice to see the painting as a realm of potential meaning that cannot be reduced into its parts. In 2017, the show traveled to the Jumex Museum in Mexico City, making this Ryman's first show in Latin America. My insistence on space, depth, and distance has served as a way for me to comprehend how these works, those three, fit inside of his whole practice as one-to-one paintings, as well as a part of a group. I think of them as encounters. I hope that these concepts help viewers do the same in their encounters with these paintings. Thank you. Ryman was too powerful. He just turned it off. I'm happy to take questions if you have any.
Yeah. I know that your interest goes beyond the use of white, but could you talk about that transition in his career when he went from color to white, and your point about surface being seeming to be all important to him, to me makes a lot of sense as to why he might then go to white. But could you talk about that?
Sure. So I think that one of the things that's often really confusing
about the work is that they are not just white. They really aren't. So the first thing is that there's always underpainting. And if you get really close, which you're never supposed to do, of course, and I don't advocate this, but you can, that you really see how much he's underpainting and how many layers of paint there are. There are vibrant colors, blues, greens, yellows in the late 60s. In the sort of 70s into the 80s, you get this sort of maroon color that's like almost dark. You know, like it's going towards black sometimes. You move from the early sort of what I would call the sort of seafoam green kind of colors that you'll see from the late 60s into the 70s. And then in the 80s, they'll return, but there'll also be navy blues as well. Lighter reds will show up. And then there is, of course, the orange. which is there in so many of those early paintings and will occasionally make a reappearance later on. I feel at times like I'm looking at those works to try to figure out what exactly is there, because there is no record of how he underpainted or what he underpainted with. And the people who have looked at this and really asked questions don't get good answers, which I think is even better, that he is sort of, you know, he's always refused to really answer that question, forcing you to find the answer for yourself. So if you keep looking, you will find it. So I think that there is never so much a transition to white. I think it's more so that the white is working as a kind of top coat underneath all of these other things. And if you were to compare the sort of whites to white, you'd get this, you'd get a real gradation. So some of the whites are really sparkling and you know, sort of optic white, you know, like that paint color, that kind of white, a titanium white at times. Some of the whites are dull and they're gray and they almost look sort of muddy and brown at times. Some become really creamy and they almost feel as if they have sort of warm caramel kind of undertones. So I think that if we were to all see them kind of lined up, you would see that they're never actually white. But I think it would also give you a clue to the fact that the white is really there to make you see the other colors. But you've got to be willing to look. I think one of the things that we all do is probably not stand there and stare long enough. And I think you will get all of those colors if you're willing to do it. There was a first part of your question that I didn't answer properly.
Well, I'm wondering about the it sounds like that white operates as a way to cover up so that you then investigate the full depth of it. But I'm wondering about the relationship of using white, mm-hmm. even as that top layer, the relationship of that with his interest in surface.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it makes you realize, you know, this is such a poor example of what these works really look like. You know, some of that work is so densely painted that it looks as if it's been, you know, quite worked physically over and over. Some things are really lightly painted. The work on paper that I showed you feels like a wash at times, and then the splatters of paint that come that are in that same work feel as if they've just kind of been piled up onto the canvas. So there are, you know, real purposeful maneuvers between the depth of paint, the way that the paint textures function. There are several paintings in which different textured levels, so you will have sort of paint feeling kind of brushy going in one direction, and then you'll have paint that feels almost as if it's been smoothed by a palette knife going in the same direction, and they'll be side by side. So what you do really get to see is that variance in texture, the variance in, you know, so the amount of material on the canvas, and the way in which that forces you into a conversation around depth with those works. One of the things that's great about the three-dimensional paintings is that they are so, so flat, and yet they are three-dimensional. So he's playing then again with our experience of what the paint looks like, you know, right at that surface level. Anne?
If you don't mind if I ask you a question about your curatorial practice and relationship to Ryman, I was very curious or struck by your what I would just call generosity in dialoguing with the curators that had worked before on Ryman in the previous exhibitions. And it didn't strike me as a way of like, I have to come up with something new or I have to, but it was like kind of, a generosity, a respect of wanting to learn from them. And then I started thinking, is that partly because you're thinking about the ways in which those curators are in a dialogue with the artist, and that in fact it's a dialogue that could continue to shape his practice mm-hmm. through those exhibitions. So then that kind of brings me to you today and your intervention or your impact or your dialogue, and have you had enough distance to think about that, or maybe not, maybe we don't get that benefit, it's somebody who comes after us.
I have absolutely no distance from these works. I am I can tell you in how many hours from today that I'll be able to see them again, because I'll go to Beacon on the 737 train on Thursday morning, and that'll be my first stop before I actually go and put down my bag or do anything. I'll stop by and see them. I feel as if, you know, like we're friends and that we need to check in with each other. I mean, I feel quite strongly about them. But I've known these paintings for much of my life. And so it's not so much that, you know, as an art historian, I was driven towards them. It's just that, you know, being introduced to them as a child, I think, meant that they seemed so wonderful and comfortable. I was frankly very shocked when I got to college and realized that people didn't like them or that they had criticism. I just couldn't imagine what would you be critical of. I mean, that's the, I think in some ways I still do have that feeling, even though obviously, you know, I hopefully have enough nuance as an art historian to know a bit more. But, you know, that my attraction to them happened very early. And so there is that part. I have to say, though, Anne, honestly, I learned so much from the curators that I spoke to, and there are many other people that I spoke to as well, but it was also incredibly self-serving. You know, those people are so smart, and they had written about not just these bodies of work, but all kinds of other things that I, you know, was incredibly interested in. And, you know, you might say I used that as an in to be able to talk to them. And I continue to still, probably much to their annoyance, continue to try to talk to them about everything that they're working on because I'm fascinated by the way that they make things. I think now we're really comfortable with the idea that art historians have moved into a field or sort of area, subfield, called exhibition history. But I would say that I was just as interested in reading probably more theoretical concepts of art history, critical understanding of art history, as I was curatorial understanding of art history as I developed as an art historian, and I still am. And I still look at people's shows trying to think through, you know, what they might have made, why these decisions are being made at this moment, what they're doing here versus there. I still am fascinated by that.
I'm struck by how prominent his signature is as a visual element in his very early work. Does it gradually disappear, or is there an epiphany he has that signature is going to interfere with
it? It disappears, it comes back. It makes these returns in different places, and I thought maybe there was some sort of rhyme or reason to it. Paste Gallery under Susan Dunn have just closed a rhyme and drawing show in New York, and that show has a work that I had never seen before where the signature is basically the total canvas, and it's technically a drawing, but it's, you know, it is made with not just paper and not just graphite. And so the signature essentially starts in one corner and goes all the way through, and the canvas is only this big, so the signature takes up the whole thing. And when you step back just a bit, though, you can't actually read each of those letters distinctly as letters forming a word. They look more just like abstract form. So the M feels like a kind of mound, you know. The Y becomes almost a sort of diagonal in the work. I mean, it's compelling. I have no real answer about how and why the signature functions, other than I do think that like everything else, it is incredibly intentional. And when it completely disappears from the works, like it is not, you know, on the surface of any of the Classico series of paintings, I don't know if it's to make us then ask where it went. You know, I don't know if it's to draw our attention to something, the loss of something, or as much as it's maybe, you know, some other compositional device that we haven't yet clued into. But if you find out.
So I was like focused on the word encounter.
You were focused on
the word encounter. Mm-hmm. You bring up the word encounter, and especially the works in the 80s. And I don't know if this is a question, I'm not sure, but I was curious about his outreach from that point, because when I saw, I believe it was Pace, when you're showing the slide of Pace, I kept thinking of Sandbeck.
Mm-hmm.
And when you said encounter, then I look at that and I think about that moment where you come upon Sandbeck and you're like, that's an encounter.
Exactly.
As it's just string, you know what it is, but it's such a moment. And I was curious about his outreach, if you see or can speak on like who went back to him. Because, I mean, in a weird way, I kind of saw with those planes and panels, mm-hmm. and moving away from the wall, I see Bickerton, I see all these other things.
Sure.
So I'm curious about what you feel his outreach was, or maybe even influence in some way past that.
I don't, you know, it's funny. I don't know. In some ways, yes. I always think that I'm sort of counting the influences on people's work, and I think that that's one of those things that I did a lot in teaching, particularly in studio visits with younger artists, you know, saying, go see this, you're already, you know, you're thinking about this thing, go see one way that it's been solved to come up with your own way. I don't don't know what people who were making sculpture think of those works. I know what people who made sculpture at the same time, so his peers, like, I have some sense of what, you know, they thought about the work. This is the sense that it might be late, right, because it is happening in the 80s. But I don't get this idea that there is much of a dialogue around them. I mean, you know, a couple of those works were shown in the 93 show. None of the reviews of that show mentioned them. It's like they just didn't exist. You know, one is shown in the catalog, the other ones are not. The Mate Lalong show that was in Paris, not the one that was in New York, but the full show that was in Paris, you know, I think people were really attracted to the other paintings. There seems not to be the sort of attraction to those three-dimensional paintings in the same way. They've never been shown outside of that commercial show. They've never been shown on their own. And they've never been understood by Ryman or by anybody else as being a real series. And yet they so clearly speak to that. And they speak to this sense of, you know, I think that probably one of the questions that he's dealing with, and I don't think he's alone, I think Joe Baer is also in this conversation, I think somebody like Ken Noland is, of course, there as well, is something that, you know, this sense of there being a minimal painting practice, right? And that it has to be called as such because clearly they aren't minimalist because they don't really make 3D objects and they haven't adhered to the rest of the kind of open space idea. And yet, it is confusing to me that you couldn't think about open space just because you're using the wall as a part of your space. And I think they were. So more so, I think it frees up a lot of people to do things they want to do. I think it also, you know, it allows people who will come about in the 90s, I think this is where you get to someone like Ashley Bickerton, you know, that kind of generation of people, you know, there's a real freedom around calling things that you... Calling your objects by what you decide them to be, even if they appear to be something else. And so I think, I look at a lot of the people right now who are making paintings inside of installations and really want to call themselves painters, even though there is this, you know, kind of armature around them of the installation itself, of which they also still feel connected to. Thank you very much.